This is Spectrum.
Alternative Myth, Homeopathy, Secret Society, Hypnosis, The Paranormal, Alternative Energy, UFO, Abduction, The Weird, The Wild, and The Wonderful.
With your hosts, Tom Theophanes and Scott Jordan.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Spectrum Radio Network on BBS Radio 2. This is Scott Jordan here with my co-host, Tom Theophanes, and remember, there's no such thing as too much information. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Just a quick heads up about next week's program. We'll be holding a special event. On Tuesday, December 14th, we will be doing two shows instead of our regular single show. The first show will be at 3:55 p.m. Pacific, and it'll run till 5:55 p.m. Pacific, when Bill Ryan will be joining us for a live webinar with BBS Radio listeners and Project Avalon Forum members. They will be able to ask Bill Ryan questions live in the PA chat. All links will be provided on the website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com, and Bill will answer those questions live on the radio. This is a much-anticipated event by Project Avalon members and should be very exciting. And then at our regular time at 7:55 p.m. Pacific, we will be speaking with Alan Steinfeld, who is a show on BBS Radio previous to ours. Check out the website, www.spectrumradionetwork, for details under upcoming guests. Lloyd, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Almost 2 months ago, on October 9th, a Sumerian scholar passed away. Of course, I'm talking about Zachariah Sitchin. And was his work any inspiration or stepping stone to your research into human origins?
Yes, it was, very much, in fact. He influenced me tremendously. I had been working for about 20 years in about 1990 when I found his work finally. His first book came out in 76, but I didn't find it. There was no internet then, so it just wasn't recommended to me, and I didn't find it until 1990. For those 20 years prior to that, I had been working on my own in the field of hominoids, Bigfoot, the abominable snowman, and all that, and I had come to some very strong and serious conclusions about that. I knew that they were the indigenous upright walking primates of planet Earth, and we didn't really belong here. We didn't have a place in the fossil record, but I had no idea that I could believe, that I could accept how we actually got here. And then I read Sitchin's work, and I had my answer, so I knew that I could take his work, that I had the front end of what he had, and he had the back end of what I needed. And by putting the two together, I could make something very unique and original and useful. And so that's what I did, and Everything You Know Is Wrong, and my career took off from there. So I owe him a lot.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be sorely missed. He was a brilliant scholar. I've read every book that he put out. And it was 20-something years ago I read that, you know, so it was a real eye-opener. I mean, it was like getting cold water thrown in your face, going, what, really? Could that be possible? But he lays it out as the other thing is I've noticed is he's so scholarly that the depth of his books are like reading a textbook. And you sort of went away from that a little bit. You have your textbook qualities, but you also wrote it in a way, and I'm talking about Everything You Know Is Wrong. You wrote it in a way that the common man can just, you know, somebody without a degree in Sumerian can read it and go, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Well, understand that English was Zechariah's third language. He was born in Russia. He was raised in Palestine, so he started out with Russian and then Yiddish, and then he moved to English. So he didn't quite master it exactly. He wrote very well, but it's kind of a stodgy style that makes it hard for some people to get it. And part of what I wanted to do was make his information at least more accessible. I'd been writing for 30 years at the point when I wrote the book almost, and I've been, you know, English is my first language, so I just have some advantages over him there, and I wanted to make his material more accessible. So in part four of my book, I just sort of boil his down into that part and give like the cliff notes to the basic fundamentals of his work for those who can't really hack his stuff, which can be tough, especially in his first three books. In his later books, it gets easier. In his last book, it's just beautifully well written. I would imagine that he started getting some real good editorial help toward, you know, for his last books, because they read a lot better than, I don't know if you read his last one, There Were Giants Upon the Earth, but beautifully well done and very mm-hmm. easy to read and understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I started out with what, you know, I guess a lot of people, the 12th Planet.
And, well, you really should start with the 12th Planet. That's his fundamental text. And really, whenever people contact me wanting to get into that area of study, I always tell them, read the first three in order first, and then you can go pretty much anywhere after that. But you really more or less have to read the 12th Planet, Stairway to Heaven, and The Wars of Gods and Men to really yep. get the overall view of what was going on back then, and the rest of it is just spreading out from there.
So, Lloyd, can you give us a kind of a rundown how you got into this from the beginning?
Well, I was a senior in college back in 1968, so it's a long time ago. And I read a book about hominoids, The Abominable Snowman by Ivan Sanderson, and I just got hooked. And so I wanted to know everything I could find out about that subject. And I started digging, and, you know, with no internet and no real great links of communication in that field. I'm from Louisiana. Most of that was going on in the Pacific Northwest. It was very difficult. So I just did it kind of catch as catch can as I was living my life and gathering it. And over time, like I said, it was a very slow process, 20 years working on it, making a living. Then found Sitchin's book, and I knew that I could make something good and original and useful. So that's what I did. I focused on that, did my first nonfiction book, Everything You Know Is Wrong, and, you know, just my life just took a completely different turn after that.
You had already done some writing previous to that.
Yeah, I'd written fiction for quite some time. I'd written a couple novels that were published. I had been in Hollywood for most of the 80s working as a screenwriter, television writer. So, you know, I'd been writing for quite a while and, you know, never to very much success, but I just thought, you know, fiction was where it was for me. But when I finally turned my hand to nonfiction, which I'd kind of disdained up to that point, I found out that I was really very skilled at it, and that's where my abilities were all the time, and I just didn't realize it.
So you started out talking about Bigfoot, Sasquatch, the Abominable Snowman, Yeti, the Almas, and the Agagways. I just gave four types of hominids, but I know you know a lot more detail. So if you want to talk about that a little bit, you can lead into
Well,
that.
They're basically, most people feel like that there's just Bigfoot or the Abominable Snowman or Sasquatch. They hear these names and they think it's all the same creature, which is not true. There are four different physical types that live on all continents except Antarctica. They're very common out there. The Earth is their planet, basically. They have lived here for millions of years, literally, back well deep into the Miocene, at least 20 million years ago, with Morotopithecus, one of the Miocene apes, walking upright. So it's clear in the fossil record that we have these upright walking apes that science just tends to ignore and refuses to deal with the fact that we have the evidence, because that evidence is something they just don't want to cope with. They don't want to have to try to explain, so they just ignore it, but it's there. So you have these four different types, the giant kind, which are indeed the Bigfoot, Sasquatch kind, which are 8 or 9 feet tall, then you have the Yeti, Abominable Snowman type, and they're about man-size, 5 to 7 feet tall. You have a different kind of man-size one, the Almas and Captars, and then you have the pygmy kind, which are the Sadapas and the Agagwis, and the Hobbit of Indonesia is of that type, and they're about 3 to 4 feet tall, the pygmy kind. So that's it. They are distinct, unique, living in different environments around the world. Most people think it's silly to imagine that because, you know, they think humans live everywhere, that we cover all of the Earth, when in fact we live predominantly in about 50%, literally 50% only, of the arable land. Take away the ice caps, take away the deserts, and what you have left are extremely dense montane forests in much of the world. You have very deep and dense jungles in much of the world, and in those areas, we may skirt the edges, we may carve roads through, but we don't really live there. It's just too hard for us physically to live in these places where they live. And so we've just sort of divvied up the world. We took the good places, the clear places, and they take the woods, the forests, and the jungles for themselves.
Yeah, the coast. We like the coastline. We're big on that. There was an older study that used to say that there was 40% wild wilderness, and then a newer study came out and said, "No, it's 50%. It's 50%."
Actually, it used to be over 50%. We're denuding the Amazon at such a fantastic clip that it actually might be under 50% by now.
Okay.
But not by much. But nonetheless, we are stripping areas of the earth of their vegetative cover, particularly forests in the Amazon, and some areas in Siberia that are being cut down for mining and for pulpwood and things like that. So it does happen. But in just about every country, there are deep, dense forests. And like in the United States, don't just think about the Pacific Northwest. We have reports, good, valid sighting reports of hominoids in every single state except Hawaii. And it's not impossible that Hawaii has them, but there are parts of Hawaii where just nobody goes, and they could be out there for all anybody knows. So it's just they're there. They are absolutely all over the place. And they are seen on a regular basis, get a good 150 reports or more each year, good sighting reports. There's no idea to know how many people see them and don't report them because they know that they know science and everybody else is going to make fun of them because this is a subject that has been forbidden for major mainstream scientists to get involved in. There's UFOs, aliens, hominoids, and cold fusion. That's just off limits. Science can't fool with that.
And so, it used to be pandas, off limits. Yeah.
Well, no, the pandas were. That's back in the 1800s. The panda was the hominoid of the 1800s. People are just totally unaware of this now. But in the 1800s, there were these legends coming out of China of a black and white bear that lived in bamboo forests and seemed to be vegetarian, and every expert in the world knew there could be no such thing as a vegetarian bear, and certainly not two-toned the way the pandas were described. So no scientist bothered to go look for them because the people in China who were living with them had to be morons. So that's how it stood for quite a long time, and then a naturalist happened to be in Sichuan province and saw the hide of one and realized that they were real and was able to pay some people to get one, a live one, that he tried to bring back to Paris, and it died, but he got it skinned and stuffed, and so they knew they were real. So over the next 60 years, museums and universities would send teams into Sichuan province, which is not that big, maybe the size of Arizona in China, but very, very rugged terrain, you know, and these teams of just crack hunters going trying to get the next panda, 60 years, mind you, not constant effort, but a lot of effort, a heck of a lot of effort.
30 years, and then they gave up for a while, didn't they?
Yeah, they gave up after 30 years, and then it was just, you know, people would go hunting intermittently there, but not really thinking they were going to find a panda. And then Teddy Roosevelt's sons finally got the next one by accident. They shot it out of a tree, and then after that it was another long stretch before they got another one and another one. But the pandas, Now, you look at the panda. It's very brightly colored. It's living in a green environment, so it stands out like a sore thumb against its environment. It's a daytime animal, you know, sleeps at night, out in the day, slow-moving, dim-witted, doing nothing at all to really be stealthy and staying away from hunters. It's just that the hunters are humans in an environment where they don't belong, and so they don't do well there. Well, that's now you imagine hominoids in the same kind of environment, and they're sharp, they're smart, they see better, hear better, smell better than you do. They're nocturnal animals for the most part, seldom seen in the day, much more at night. And they're just very highly mobile. So in every way, they have the advantage over us in their own environment, and it shows. That's why when we see them, it's surely by accident, and hunters that go out there with the intention of looking for them, it's like they have a sixth sense and they stay away. So it's,
or they smell them a mile away.
Well, they can smell you, yeah, but even if the wind's in your favor, you can get up on them close the way they did with the Patterson film and obviously the way Frank Hansen did when he killed the Minnesota Iceman. I mean, they've been filmed, they've been killed, they've been seen, but all that's just blown away, blown off by science is just not reliable, because all you have to do is give science an excuse to not believe it, and that's it. They rally in behind whatever reason there is to not believe it, and that's it. You know, the Patterson film, oh, well, it was filmed. It could have been faked, so there you go. That's fake.
Hey, Lloyd, do you have any knowledge of any skeletal remains of any creatures or such?
Yeah, there are the remains of Xana somewhere in a cemetery in a village called Tekina in Russia. I think it's Uzbekistan, and she was a hominoid that was kept as a slave pretty much in a community in Russia, Tekina, from about 1850 to about 1890 when she died. So in those 40 years she stayed there, and she did the heavy lifting for many of the villagers, the onerous work that has to be done in a primitive village like that. She'd carry the water, she'd fetch the wood, and she was a sex slave as well for any of the men that wanted to have her in the area. And so she ended up getting pregnant 8 times, and she produced 4 offspring that lived, offspring with humans, so they were hybrid beings with her, and she's clearly a hominoid. And they came out looking much more human than hominoid, although they were different than the other humans in the village somewhat. Noticeably, well, she's buried in there in that village's cemetery, but nobody knows where. So her son, Kvit, he had been buried about 10 years before some Russians went in and did a very careful study there about her. And so they exhumed his grave and were able to recover his skull and I think some of his body bones. So we have that much to work with. If people were willing to work on it. But again, because science just dismisses that stuff as, you know, ridiculous garbage, they don't want to be bothered. They don't want the apple cart upset on their watch. They don't want the paradigm changing while they're in charge, and so they work very hard to see that everything stays more or less the same as it is without any real big changes, like, for example, proving that hominoids are real or proving that aliens are real or anything like that. It would just wreck their careers, their lives, certainly ruin their day. And they don't want to cope with that, so they work very hard to avoid having to do it.
What sort of populations would you say these hominoids may have in the different
around areas? The world, I would imagine hundreds of thousands, literally. I mean, we're in the billions. I don't see how they could maintain breeding populations without them being in the hundreds of thousands, literally.
So we should have been able to find some more skeletal remains or something like that.
No, not really. Everybody makes that assumption, but that's not really true. If you look at the work of the Bone Farm in Knoxville, Tennessee, or at the University of Tennessee, where they study what happens to bodies that die. You die in the woods in your normal environment, in the normal woodland environment where these creatures would live. They are reduced down to nothing in just a matter of a few weeks. I mean, just down to nothing. Bones gone. I mean, you carry in your body the bacteria that are going to putrefy and take away your most of your soft tissues, including your bone marrow. And then the bones themselves are going to be consumed by bacteria and fungi that are in the ground, and it will, you know, come up and find you and break the bones down to nothing. Because, you know, if nature did not do that, you would step out of your house or wherever you are, and you'd be looking at 1,000-foot-high piles of bones all around you. You know, nature, Mother Nature cleans her plate. That is one of the great axioms of reality that most people don't understand. And the same thing applies to hominoids. When they know they're dying, when any animal that's not a prey animal, and hominoids are not prey animals, so when any non-prey animal knows it's dying, it tucks itself away somewhere. It gets sick, feels bad, knows something's wrong, gets itself out of the way so it can tend to itself, and then wherever it's tucked away and hidden, it dies. And within a matter of a few weeks, you don't even know it was there. So that's why we don't just go stumbling around and finding their bones all the time, because, number one, they're living where we don't go in the first place, and when they know they're dying, they hide themselves even further into that maze, and so it's just, you know, the odds would be a zillion to one of, you know, find somebody, one of us, finding one of their dead and decomposing bodies. It's just very, very, very unlikely.
Yeah, well, this is why the forests and the jungles aren't piled treetop level with skeletons.
Exactly. My Mother Nature just cleans it all up in a surprisingly short time. I mean, at the body farm, they do humans, but for people who are grossed out by that, they've staked down a few deer and watched them go, and, you know, they film it, time-lapse photography, and show how surprisingly quickly it all just goes down to nothing, just a stain on the ground. It's really amazing.
I want to ask about the missing link, or should there be a dozen or so missing links?
There would have to be hundreds in every species for evolution to be correct. Certainly for human evolution to be correct, it would have to be dozens. You can't go from Neanderthal or Homo erectus, either one, into Cro-Magnon without dozens of changes. I mean, dozens of transitional species, because you have 180-degree difference in every aspect of the body, of the cranium, of everything. They've got, you know, they go from heavy brow ridges to light brow ridges. They go from no forehead to a good pronounced forehead. You go from a wide, flat splayed nose to an arched up off-the-face nose. You go from a mouth extending off the face in the prognathous fashion to a flattened mouth. You go from no chin to having a chin. I mean, you go from big round night vision eyes to those squared off rectangles that we have that don't see so well at night. I mean, you just got change after change just in the head. You have these big, thick, robust bones all over the body that support extremely strong muscles changing, losing strength, bones thinning down, becoming more what the term is gracile. So, I mean, where are the transition species for all of these changes? They don't exist. You go from one to another, just literally overnight. I mean, just overnight. In the fossil record, there are no Cro-Magnons, and then, boom, around 200,000 years ago, they are. They start appearing. And ironically, that's exactly when, Sitchin says, the Sumerians claim to have created us, genetically engineering. I think the evidence for genetic engineering of humans is overwhelmingly clear in our genome, if you know anything about genetics at all, and I know all geneticists know what I know, which is that in our genome, we have our second and third primate group. All higher primates that we supposedly evolved from have 48 chromosomes. We have 46. Now, two whole chromosomes, big difference. But we have the same amount of DNA, approximately 3 billion base pairs. So that doesn't make sense. until you know that the second and third primate chromosomes have been fused end to end. Somebody nipped off the telomeres, fused the remaining ends together such that they still function. That is an incredible, incredible piece of work, whoever did that. Then, on top of that, there are nine other chromosomes in the human genome that have segments that were pulled out, turned upside down, flipped, they're called inversions, flipped end on end, and put back in. Now, how does science explain that? Well, they just say nature can do anything, so nature did it. Somehow nature did that. That's just garbage. Nature can't do that. That was done by hand, by somebody that knew what they were doing, in a genetics lab, period.
And are there's no other examples of that happening?
Yes, there are examples of all kinds of finagling going on in genomes. You've got multiple strands of chromosomes. You got all kinds of finagling, but it's always in domesticated plants and animals, because that's what the Anunnaki were doing. They were creating species to make their life on Earth easier. This was not their ideal. This was a hardship duty for them. They were away from their home planet, so they had to shape this planet to suit themselves so they would be comfortable living here. So they created a lot of domesticated plants and a lot of domesticated animals, things they could eat, things they could use and work with. And we, human beings, are a part of that program, that program of, quote, giving the gods their ease, as it says in the Sumerian tablets. They wanted to give the gods their ease, meaning make life easy on themselves. And so they created a slave and servant in us, and a sex object. Let's not kid ourselves. They were mostly men, and they needed women. I mean, you know, that's just the way it is. When you send a bunch of men off somewhere away from home, they want women. So they made something that was compatible with them physically and in some degree emotionally, but not mentally. They didn't want us to be, you don't want your slave and your servant to be anywhere near as smart as you are. So they dumbed us down incredibly. This is why the people, you hear that thing about we only use about 10% of our brains. You can hear arguments that we use every part of it at different times, but we never use it all at once. We can only use small portions of it at any one time, leaving probably 90% of it. I don't know what the average is, but I would say probably in the range of 90%, because when you look at the skills, the incredible abilities of savants, and you see the incredibly wide range of their phenomenal skills, and you understand that if those skills are in their brains, those skills are in our brains. The difference is, we're normal, and so the partition that the Anunnaki put in our brains is still functional. But in savants, they lose the part of their brain, or the full access of the part of their brain that is normal, and in the loss of that, there's some kind of a tear in the curtain, and it gives them a glimpse, a beam of light into some aspect of the hidden 90% from the rest of us, and those single beams of light into those single aspects of what they carry around in their heads the same way we do allows them to have those phenomenal math abilities and art abilities and music abilities and spatial abilities and drawing abilities and all the skills that they have. All of that combined, you look at the combined evidence of savants, there's no doubt we carry that in our heads, and we just don't have access to it the way they do in the accident of their births that costs them their normal functioning but gives them those incredible skills and insights that they get in small, narrow doses, but enough to be mind-boggling to the rest of us.
Yeah, that, and I would argue that humans don't seem to be suited to survive here. I mean, if you stripped all of our clothes off and threw us out in a four-season climate, we wouldn't do very well. The strength, we don't really we're not really that strong. You put us in a cage with an ape and with no, you know, weapons, just hand on hand, and I don't think we'd be walking out of the cage.
No, they tear us limb from limb. They're 5 to 10 times stronger than us, pound for pound. So if you just put us in there with a chimp, forget a gorilla, a chimp. A chimp could tear us apart, and not a problem. So, yeah, we're not physically adapted nor well-equipped for this planet. If you stripped us all naked and put us out there to make or break, all of us who are white would very soon be suffering from poisoning from the sun. We'd have to stay in the shade a lot. We couldn't really be out there all the time. People with, of course, black skin have a much better chance and are able to do that. But everybody has to live at the equator. You put them up in the higher latitudes, black people with no clothes, they're going to starve, freeze like the rest of us. So, yeah, we would all have to live in a very near, like other things, like normal creatures live where they are physically designed to live.
Mm-hmm.
We break that rule because we are able to, you know, make clothes. That's basically it. We don't fit the pattern of everything else here on Earth. And there's a reason for that. We're not natural to the planet. Everybody likes to believe that we somehow are, you know, blessed and evolved better and all that. It's garbage. We were made this way. And so when we get to the point where we can accept that, acknowledge that we're just a part of a much larger community out there and not really a very good part of that community, then maybe that community might begin to let us in on some of the secrets that they have about how to live better and do better, and maybe we'll be able to get our act together. But until we get to the point of being able to acknowledge our true position in the universe, I don't think they're going to bother with us. Why would they? We're still not worthy, just not worthy.
Yeah. I think the human race, if that would slow down and eventually stop murdering each other, would be a bonus, would be a step.
Well, that would be great, but you know, we certainly have a very long way to go to get to that point. Although I have to say that if we were to get to some kind of position in reality where we knew and accepted that there were, you know, it was a higher authority that we had to answer to. And if that higher authority came down and just said, okay, you will quit doing these things or else, you know, you will be eliminated, or, you know, some kind of punishments in there. If that happens, if that were to happen, if we were to start being, you know, dominated and ruled and coordinated by other beings who might or might not have our best interests at heart, then we'd really have no choice. But I don't know that. I mean, right now, look how it is. There are people in the world trying to kill other people in the world who are very heavily armed, who can absolutely eliminate, for example, in the Middle East. Everybody accepts that Israel has dozens and dozens of nuclear weapons. They could just scorch Earth, the whole place, and yet there are constantly people picking on them. So, you know, if we're that stupid today, now, and we're clearly that, there are people out there who are that stupid and just don't, you know, they'll take everybody else down with them rather than suffer any kind of slight. It might not work if some higher authority were to come in and say, look, if you don't got, you know, we'll give you 6 months, get it together, or else we probably would not get it together, which is not, you know, I don't think we're smart enough to do it.
If another race showed up and started floating over all the cities, we'd have to post, please don't shoot at the alien signs everywhere, you know?
Well, we'd be the aliens.
At that point.
We'd be the ones begging not to get shot at. Yeah, if they, you know, it isn't a question of them being here. Everybody knows they're here. I mean, there are too many sightings, too many, you know, they're here. Everybody knows they're here. Anybody that says they don't, they're doing it because that's what they are obligated to say. I don't think anybody really believes they're not here. So the question is, when do they make themselves known to us, and so that there's no more doubt about it? and that day will come. I don't know, you know, I expect to live to see it, and most of us should, because it shouldn't be that much further down the line. Disclosure is building on a number of fronts. All you have to do is get out on the internet and see what's going on, and certainly the Star Child has a role in that. So it's just a matter of time. I don't know what's going to be the thing that creates the tipping point, where whether a UFO will land on the White House lawn or the Star Child or something else that we can't anticipate at the moment, but something's going to happen that's just going to force the U.S. government in particular to just throw up its hands and say, all right, you got us. We've been hiding this information for 60, 70 years, however long it has been, and we're going to tell you this much about it, and you know, I'm sure it won't be all, but
and that's all you're gonna get. Well, we gotta go to a quick break, and we'll be right back. See you on the other side.
Are you suffering from constant pain in the knee, shoulder, wrist, and other parts of your body? Needle-free acupuncture with Lapingo Life Pads may be the answer. Lapingo Life Pads combine ancient wisdom with modern nanotechnology and advanced engineering. They're designed to relieve pain naturally with no needles and no side effects. That's Lepingo, lapingoproducts.com.
You've always been told to think about the alternative. Well, we can do better. We can show you. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com will improve your health, well-being, and lifestyle through hundreds of different products, from herbs and well-being products to our large selection of specialty clothing, jewelry, and more. We ship around the world with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. There's always new products and amazing specials. Let us show you at AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com.
Oh, hello, and we're back with Lloyd Pye. Lloyd Pye is a researcher who wrote a book called Everything You Know Is Wrong. He's now on a campaign to get some information out there on the Star Child skull. Leading into that, maybe you can tell us about the Star Child skull and how it connects. How does this connect to what we were talking about previously?
Well, Scott, the Star Child skull is a real true bone skull found in Mexico about 1930 that came into my purview in early 99, and for the last, in February it'll be 12 years, I've been running as many scientific tests as I could afford at any given time on it to find out what it is, but really it comes down to its DNA. Every other test it passes, it shows that it's not entirely human, but it comes down to DNA to prove it one way or the other. And so this year we've had some very good luck with a geneticist coming on board with us who's decided to do what he could to help us, and he's found that we can indeed recover its nuclear DNA. And that DNA is partially human without question, and part of it is going to be not human, not found on Earth. Although we've only recovered a small portion of the full 3 billion base pair genome, we've recovered only about 30,000 at this point. And he's trying to get a base, what's called a library, of between 300,000 and 3 million, which again is still very, very small compared to 3 billion, but it's enough to where 30,000 base pairs, people can argue that it's not substantial enough, even though it is, but it's very hard to argue at the 300,000 to 3 million range, because then, you know, you're cutting a thin slice of bread off the end of the loaf, but that's enough to tell you what the loaf is. So that's really where we're going to be in the next few weeks or month or so, we hope. And once we have that, then we should be able to get a little bit more mainstream attention for what we're doing, and then we should be able to get the money that we need to do the actual recovery of the genome. So it's a slow and a step-by-step process, but we keep moving in the right direction, and eventually we're going to win, because we do have the evidence and the facts on our side.
Who found the skull, by the way?
Well, it was a young girl. She was 13, 14, 15 at the time. In later life, she couldn't remember how old she was, but it was around 1930. And when she found him in a mine tunnel about 100 miles southwest of Chihuahua, Mexico, out in the middle of basically nowhere, in a high desert area in an abandoned mine tunnel. She found it and a human skeleton together, its skeleton and a human skeleton. She recovered Zeus skulls, just kept them as souvenirs. She just assumed it was a deformity, and so she kept the two skulls her whole life. And when she was dying in the early 90s, she passed them on, and they ended up with a couple named Ray and Melanie Young in El Paso. And Ray and Melanie got in touch with me and turned it over to me to find out what it was. And here I am, 12 years later. I thought it would be maybe 6 months max, and here I am 12 years later. But it's been a really fascinating journey, difficult journey, but fascinating. I've known since pretty much late 99. Late in the first year, I knew pretty much that it was the real deal and was going to, there would be eventually a way to prove it was not entirely human. And now here we are with that capacity, and all we have to do is get the money lined up, and we'll be able to do it. So that's where we are right now.
Just for our listeners, anybody who's interested, Lloyd has an update he does by email called Bites of Pie. You could get that, I believe, by going to your site, www.pie.com.
Yeah, if you go to www.starchildproject.com, that's starchildproject.com. And you will see how to sign up for that mailing list. And Scott's right, the Bites of Pie are the way that I communicate pretty much with the outside world. I almost never go to Facebook or YouTube. I just or never Twitter, never do any of those things
yeah.
that I'm supposed to be doing because I just have my hands full doing everything else.
Well, I mean, you're all over the place, aren't you? I mean, you're very busy doing lectures and trying to follow up on this and being asked
right.
to.
Yeah, it's a tough job, and it is. It's very time consuming, and like right now, I'm working on revising the ebook. There's so much happened this year that the ebook needs another revision. So I'm in the process of doing that, and I'm really plumping it out and you know filling it up with more good information, and so it's going to be a much better deal than it's ever been before. And by the say the weekend, I think. Also, a filmmaker in Oslo, Norway, Terje Toftnes, New Paradigm Films, interviewed me while I was there. An extensive interview, about 90 minutes, regarding the Star Child. And that video is going to be on YouTube in the next day or two, I would imagine. So a lot of things happening vis-a-vis the Star Child for people who want to learn more about it in detail. Those are two good ways to do it.
And that ebook will be available on your Star Child site?
On the website, yeah. It's called Star Child Skull Essentials, Star Child Skull Essentials. And it is available on the website as well. So, and the thing that's going to be coming out from Norway, if anybody's on the mailing list getting the Bites of Pie, as soon as I know what the link is, I'll be sending it out in the next day or two.
Great. So I'll know and I'll tell our listeners when it's
there
available.
There you go. That should not be a problem then.
I'm on the list.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
okay,
great.
Good.
The other thing I want to talk about is I know that there's been a lot of stuff done on the Star Child skull. There was wasn't there a thing I seen? I can't remember where it was. You're going to have to fill me in on this. Where the two skulls were put side by side and filled with sand, and they were looking for the capacity of the skull itself.
Right. It wasn't sand. It's flaxseed. A little small
flaxseed. Right.
Flaxseed. And then the reason they use that is because they pour out fairly easily and are easy to measure in a container. To measure the volume of a skull, you put a thin lining of plastic in there, just a plastic bag, really, basically. And then you blow it out so that it fills all the nooks and crannies, and then you fill it up with the flaxseed. And then when it's full, when it's packed in, you take the flaxseed out and you put it in a long cylindrical container that has markings on it to show you volume. And so when we did the human skull found with the star child, the two of them are basically the same size. They are a little smaller than normal. They're about the size of a 5 foot tall adult or about a 12 year old who's going to grow up to be, you know, 5'7" or better. So you have about 1,200 cubic centimeters in the human skull found with it. So the star child should have 1,200 cubic centimeters. Now, you and I, average people, we have about 1,400 cubic centimeters. So the star child should have 1,200, and it had 1,600 cubic centimeters, which is 200 more than a normal person and 400 more than it ought to have had. And that's an awful lot of extra brain to go in that head. So we really honestly don't know to this point where it all goes, because certainly the fact that the star child lacks frontal sinuses, that's a pretty good chunk, but it isn't nearly all 400 cubic centimeters. The fact that it has very shallow eye sockets, less than half as deep as normal human eye sockets, that's another pretty good chunk, but it isn't enough. The fact that it has expanded parietals, that's a lot of extra brain, but the rear of the head is very flattened, so that sort of takes away what you gain with the expanded parietals. So all you're left with is the thinness of the bone. Now, the bone is one half or less as thick uniformly all the way around, so that is a lot of extra room too, but none of us figure that accounts all told for the extra 400. So we're just not quite sure. We know there's an answer. We know there's a way, because that's what came out, but it's still a real puzzle when you look at trying to figure out how to account for it.
Yeah.
Was there any part of the jawbone or any of the teeth found with it?
Yes. The upper right maxilla, if you put your finger on the middle of your top lip in that little dent in the skin above your lip, and you swing your finger to the right, the right upper maxilla was found minus its rear tooth. So two teeth were found that were down and out and exposed. Three in front were gone. And then when you x-ray the small, tiny piece of bone, it's about an inch long. It's very small. When you x-ray it, the top part of it, you find, lo and behold, that there are five teeth ready to come down. So that fooled us in the beginning. The first test we did was x-ray, and the technician said, well, you've got teeth down and you got teeth up in the bone like that, so that makes this a child age 5 or 6, you know, going through the process of losing its teeth, and new teeth are coming in. We just bought it because we didn't know any better, so that's how we came to call it the star child. Only later did we find out that those teeth that were down were both heavily worn on their surfaces, much more than a child could wear them, you know, eating, and they were heavily rooted, which is not children's teeth. Children's teeth have light roots, when they're ready to fall out, those roots are absorbed so that the tooth can come out. You know, when a child pulls their own tooth out, it doesn't have any roots. That's how it's able to come out. So, that's it.
So it's a star adult.
Star adult. Yeah, definitely star adult. We don't know what age it was when it died, but well up, I would say at least in the late teens to early 20s. But it could have been 500 years old. We don't know. I mean, if you got a situation where the teeth wear down and you've got teeth up in the top to replace it, like sharks, then you could be looking at an enormous lifespan. We just don't know.
Or non-human.
Definitely not a human lifespan in that sense, no.
Would you say there's any sort of connection to the elongated skulls that were found all over the world, pretty much?
Well, that's Tom, right? asking that question? Yeah. Tom, the Coneheads are a dominant culture, a part of the superculture that existed on the Earth at some point in the past, because they're not really entirely human either, I'm sure. When you look at a species that has a brain twice the size of ours, we were talking about the brains earlier, we average about 1,400 cubic centimeters. The Coneheads have skulls filled with brains. I mean, if x-rayed them, there's no doubt, filled with brains, not fluid on the brain, not fluid in the brain, brains that are about 2,800 to 3,000 cubic centimeters. So they have double our brain capacity. Now, their faces are much more human-like than is the Star Child's face, but those faces they have some differences. They have heavier jaws, heavier bones, thicker bones. So they've got some distinct differences from us. I would suspect that if a Conehead were to be genetically engineered, it too will show up as not entirely human. But to my knowledge, nobody has ever done any kind of, not even a mitochondrial DNA test on a Conehead. Now, the obvious question is why? I mean, it seems like such a simple thing to do. There's hundreds of them around the world. There's 200 or 300 in Peru in museums alone. So why not? Well, like with the Star Child, it's an answer they don't want to deal with. So these subjects that could provide an answer that is going to upend the current prevailing paradigm is something science works hard to avoid dealing with, because none of them want to be in charge. They don't want it to happen on their watch because of the upheaval that is going to be brought. And that's really the bottom line.
And can you get this result from with the skull by wrapping it or boarding it, putting, you know, there's cultures that have done this in the past.
Well, with the Star Child, with the Coneheads or with the Star Child? Because in both cases, the answer is no. In both cases, the answer is no. If you look at the Conehead skulls, if you look at the Star Child skull, you will see that it has its natural convolutions. It has its normal convolutions in the bone. If you look at the human found with it, you find that the rear of her head is flat as the board that she was strapped to as an infant, because when you're cradle boarded, your bones are so soft they take the shape of a board if that's what you're strapped to. Now, some heads can be deliberately deformed, and they are, but the bones always show evidence of the deformation process, whether it's a boards tied around the head, or a series, as in some tribes in Africa, string very tightly wound around the head. But whatever the deforming mechanism is, it leaves traces on the soft bones of the baby, because you can't deform them once they get out of babyhood, once the bones begin to stiffen up and begin to fuse together at their sutures. So you only have a narrow window when you can do this reshaping.
Right.
And the bones are so soft then, they always show evidence of it. So the Coneheads show no evidence of that kind of binding, nor does the Star Child. So they are both natural in their wild variation from human, which to me says their genes are different from ours. Their genes are telling them to grow in a way that is just so distinctly different from ours. Those differences in those genes are going to show up when somebody sequences their full genomes. So that's what I'm about. If nobody's done it by the time we're finished with the Star Child and I have the money to arrange it, that's exactly what I intend to do. Coneheads next on the list.
Oh, you got that. You've got that on your planner.
Absolutely.
That's great.
On my planner.
I have another question that's been kind of bugging me now. If Neanderthals and our species were more or less around the same time period together.
Right, we were, no question.
What happened to the Neanderthals?
Well, the Neanderthal, in my opinion, are hominoids. They are part of the natural fauna of planet Earth. and I think like all the other hominoids, they were driven into seclusion by the humans, by the Cro-Magnons. And so they live, I think they live on in the mountains and woods of Europe and the places where they lived, you know, before. And I don't believe they went extinct 30,000 years ago, like we're told, or 28,000 years ago or whatever. We just haven't found any new fossils, or if we have, and let's not rule out the possibility that we have, mainstream science does not let such discoveries be announced. Whenever there are many, many things out there that are called collectively uparts, which is out-of-place artifacts, O-O-P-A-R-T-S, uparts. And there are all kinds of uparts, not just fossilized bones that are considered uparts and shouldn't be there. There's all kinds of things. There's tools.
Yeah, that forbidden archaeology.
Forbidden archaeology, exactly. Yeah, that's Michael Cremo's field. But it isn't just Michael Cremo. There are others who worked at that field as well. Cremo's the best known of that group. But there are people who do outstanding work in the world of uparts. And so what happens, or at least what happened early in the history of the Americas for sure, is when people would discover really weird things, there was only one place to go with them, and that was the Smithsonian Institution. So they would ship those to the Smithsonian. So rumor has it, I can't prove this, but rumor has it, that twice, at least twice, possibly a third time, but at least twice, the Smithsonian gathered up its weirdest things that it didn't want to have to deal with, like giant skeletons, for example, when people would find 8, 9, and 10-foot-tall skeletons in the country, they would send the bones to the Smithsonian. So after a time, supposedly, they loaded up barges, just a standard, ordinary barge, towed it out to way, way out past the continental shelf out into the middle of the Atlantic, and then scuttled the barge with full of artifacts, full of uparts, that things they just didn't want to deal with, things that didn't fit. Now, again, that's a rumor. I can't prove it, but it makes sense because you have all these newspaper reports from the 17 and 1800s, particularly of the 1800s and early 1900s, of these bizarre things being found locally. The local newspapers run articles about them, and then they get sent away to Washington, and boom, they're never heard from again. So to me, that story about sinking bargefuls of uparts rings true as something that could be distinctly possible.
I suppose that would be easier than explaining it.
Is it possible the Star Child could be a different species that we're just not familiar with?
No. A terrestrial species, no. Because it has things about it, Roy, that are just completely different from terrestrial species. It has those fibers woven through its bone, and that's not known in any other species on Earth. It has those red residue found in its cancellous holes, which is also not found in any other species on Earth. And you have that bone that's so very hard that its biochemistry is more like tooth enamel. Again, not found on Earth. It's got enough going for it that doesn't look human in any way, shape, or form, to where, you know, I'm prepared to believe that the most it'll turn out to be is a human-alien hybrid, with the human actually having very little input, relatively speaking, because there's just not much human left in the Star Child skull.
I wonder what sort of degrees of difference we're talking about here, because there's a degree of difference between the human and the ape,
right?
In a percentage point.
Well, with the percentage of genome difference between us and a chimp is about 3%. So 97% their genome is the same as our genome. 3% makes the difference. 90 million base pairs. Okay, so gorillas are like 5% different. So they're 95% the same. 150 million base pairs make the difference between us and a gorilla. A mouse is 70% the same genome, 30% difference. So you get kind of a perspective from that. Now, here's what's stunning. The star child, based on where we are right now with our very early conclusions drawn on about 30,000 base pairs recovered, is that the star child's going to have a percentage of difference from a normal human in the range of, now you know, grab your seats here, between 10 and 50%. So it's going to be twice as different as a gorilla. But to somewhere between 10 and 50%. Now, that's, you know, it's a very wide range right now because we have a very small sample relative to the whole thing. But it is a sample that is enough to be indicative of what the final result would be while not being anywhere near definitive. It is indicative.
On the fibers, was there any fungi or bacteria found on them?
No, we had that checked out very thoroughly by mycologists who found a segment of bone, which is available in the ebook and maybe on the website, but certainly found a segment of bone where you can see one of the fibers very clearly laid into the surface of the bone, yet buried in the matrix. So there's no doubt these things or these fibers are somehow woven into the matrix like rebar in concrete to give added durability to the bone, which is very thin, very light, and it just needs some strengthening, and so it got what it needed.
That's great. But
you didn't find any specific bacteria or fungi on the fiber itself?
No. The cuts... When you cut out pieces of bone like that, there's just no chance for bacteria and fungi to develop. I mean, if you cut it right and you get it in the test tubes quickly so that they're just protected, you don't get any contamination to speak of. You really don't. No contamination over and above what it's already picked up just by being in the ground for 900 years and being in the cardboard boxes in people's garages and being handled by people as well.
But are the fibers, like what size would the fibers be?
Microscopic, very, very small. Nothing like the Morgellons fibers that people talk about, you know, that they see come up and form blisters on their skin and then they'll ultimately come out. Whatever that is, it's not what the star child has. The fibers of the star child are, as I said, woven through the matrix of the bone, which is not where Morgellons fibers are found, and then they are very, very microscopic in relation to the others.
Sounds like a good... something you could write into a movie, say, I don't know, Avatar?
Something like that, right.
Yeah, the bones are they have fibers in them. I heard that, and I was like, wow, I've heard that before somewhere. Oh, wait, Lloyd mentioned
right,
that.
Right, when we saw that, we looked at each other like, what? You know, but it's not impossible that they take things like that and use them. He might, James Cameron might very well have heard about it and thought, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's add that. Who knows? I mean, he'd never admit that, of course, because he would be afraid that we would make some kind of claim against it. But, you know, it's not impossible. There was something, I forget what, too, in the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. There was something that seemed to relate as well, but
Didn't they have the elongated skulls in that movie?
They did. They had the cone heads in there. Exactly. Yes, they did.
Yeah, they were at the end of them. They had a whole bunch of them in a circle or something. It was really wild.
Yeah, there's supposedly 13 of them and all that. But the only crystal skull really worth anything is the Mitchell Hedges skull, because it's so physically unlikely that humans could have made that. It's really, its complexity is the Grand Canyon on a very small scale, but very, very complex and very precise. It's just, whatever that is, it's incredible.
Yeah, there is, I read on the internet there was someone or an interview where someone was trying to say, oh, they're ground down. They just ground them down. No big deal. They just used abrasives, finer and finer and finer abrasives to make the
It's just that's dating of it. You just couldn't do that. Not to the precision. I mean, I've seen it. I've seen the Mitchell Hedges skull. I've spent time with it. And the cusps of its teeth. Now it's small. It's not fully human size. It's smaller than the Star Child.
Yeah, I've held it in my hand.
There you go. Well, then, if you miss Mitchell Hedges, you know what I'm talking about. Those teeth in that jawbone, the cusps fit perfectly with the cusps above. You know how teeth are supposed to fit?
Yeah.
Well, there's a little bit of overlap, and the middle of each tooth allows for the bite from an upper tooth to come down on it like that. And, you know, it's just a beautiful, beautiful system the way it's up. These teeth are perfect, and they're tiny. They're small. I had to put my glasses on to see the, you know, I still have pretty good eyes, but not that good. So, when you look at all of the absolute utter perfection of this thing, cut against at least 3 grains of the quartz and possibly 4, and that rock crystal is almost next to diamonds in terms of hardness. So whoever says somebody was sitting there scraping it down with sand is obviously never fooled with that material. That material is absolutely not going to yield to that in anyone's lifetime. So it's just, you know, the Mitchell Hedges skull. For anybody who's interested in crystal skulls, there's really only one worth discussing, and that's it. The rest of them are obviously hand-carved because they have the lower jaw stuck to the face. The only one with that perfect lower jaw that comes on and goes off, that's legitimate.
It's something just to be in the presence of that skull, and you can't pick it up off the table because the people that are protecting the skull, looking after it, are like, you know. But I did cut my hands in it, and, you know, you have an overwhelming sense. I just had to do it, lean down and look into the eye sockets. You know, it had to be done. What an amazing skull that was.
Yeah, it is. I would urge anyone to take the opportunity if they get a chance, because like the Star Child, it's just one of a kind.
I have a picture of it. I'll scan it and put it up on the website. I got a picture before I left, and I'll scan it and put it. It's got some tendrils of light coming out of the above the nose there. I got one of the original pictures way back. It was an
amazing thing for sure.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll talk on the other side.
If you suffer or know someone that suffers from back pain, knee pain, or any other chronic or sports-related pains, you need to visit LapingoProducts.com. Dealing with pain can affect every aspect of your life, which is why our products are designed to bring you real relief. Our products are not only easy to use, effective, and safe for the entire family, but our prices are competitive and offer a complete satisfaction guarantee. Visit LapingoProducts.com, real life solutions for pain-free living.
AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is your gateway to over 500 products, ranging from herbs to pain relief products, health, and well-being. AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com is dedicated to educating and empowering you to make the best possible informed decisions about what products you can use to improve your health and well-being. Visit AlternativeLifestyleProducts.com and bring about change in your life.
And we're back.
Wrap this up because I said I'd be on from 10 to 11. It's almost 11:30 and it's past my bedtime.
You're starting to fade out there. You're like,
yeah, I am. I'm still dealing with jet lag coming back from Europe a week ago. So I've got that issue as well. So yeah, it's,
I just want to ask you one quick thing. I want to find out about the machine that it's a 4-5-4 machine or a
4-5-4 machine. Yeah, what we need to do to recover the Star Child's DNA, the entire amount in its genome, all 3 billion base pairs, you have to run it through one of two kind of machines. There's a 4-5-4, and the newer one is called the Illumina. So one or the other is going to have to be used. We're starting to think maybe instead of the 4-5-4, it might be the Illumina because of differences in the Star Child's DNA and genome. This is uncharted territory, and the more they dig into it, the more they find things they don't understand. All that's good, but it causes things to slow down because they have to figure it out once they hit the roadblocks. So they're thinking now that maybe the Illumina might do better, but whichever one it is, it's going to recover the whole genome, and that's what has to be found in order to compare it base pair by base pair to the human genome, and then we get that percentage. Instead of me saying it's somewhere between 10% and 50%, we'll know to the point what it is, and that's what we need.
And what are we talking about cost-wise for the Illuminati machine, the Illumina?
Well, it isn't just the testing. It's everything else that we need to do. We need to pay for the testing. We need to pay for the documentary filmmaking. We need to pay for the film company that will coordinate the documentary filmmaking. But, I mean, this is not, we're not asking for a donation. We're asking for an investment from someone who might be interested in doing that. I'm not supposed to give specific numbers over the air in a blanket way like this, but if anybody's interested, we're talking a few million dollars, and you know, if they can contact me, I'm very easy to get on the internet, lloyd@lloydpie.com, and I'll be happy to give them some specifics about the deal. But it is an investment, and it will, you know, make history. It'll make a lot of money. It'll pay back many times over the investment. So it's a good deal, and sooner or later somebody is going to understand that, and then we'll be underway.
Yeah, Has any
benefactors even come forward at all?
Yeah, we've had one guy that wanted to do it, and he was 81 years old. He was in failing health. He was looking for a way to leave a legacy behind. He said that he just didn't want to die as another rich old man on a big pile of money and leaving nothing behind but the fact that he made a lot of money. So he was into it. He said, if you guys are legitimate, I'll do my due diligence, and if it's good to go, I'll do it. So we knew that he would, you know, we knew we were legitimate, and we knew what he would find, so we started setting everything up that we needed to do. We got hooked up with the Texas Film Commission because there are a number of advantages with that. Even though I live in Florida, we'll have to move over to Houston to get going. They got a great entertainment attorney in Austin. We've got a great entertainment accountant in Houston. So we put the whole package together while the guy was looking at the deal. And wouldn't you know it, the day he decides to do it and tells his lawyer he's going to do it, he got so excited that that night he had a stroke and never woke up.
Wow.
So we've had to kind of pick up the pieces and move forward again. Yeah, and it don't, you know, there wasn't any foul play or anything like that. It was clear that
I was going to ask. The night he was going
to. Yeah, I know. Everybody says that, but really the truth of it was he wasn't in good shape. We all knew that dealing with him. We just didn't think that he could get that, you know, if he got excited that would happen, but apparently it did. He told the lawyer that morning he wanted him to start the paperwork, didn't sign anything, didn't put anything in writing. It was just a verbal instruction. So there was nothing to use against the family, who were not interested in following his wishes. And so that's pretty much it. We were left out when he finally succumbed.
It must be hard to get so close. I mean, to be just teetering on the edge.
Yeah, it was really devastating emotionally for quite a while. It really, really was a body blow. But I've had to recover from several of those in the course of these 12 years. So you know, it's just another one of those things that people are going to look back and say, geez, God, how do you recover from that? But, you know, you just do. You just find a way. You just reach down inside and you say, look, it's just, we've got to move forward. We've come too far. And so you pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you try to find another way. And that's what we're doing now.
Yeah, you've been pounding this out for, well, previous to this, to the Star Child, you know, with all your work with Everything You Know Is Wrong. But specifically with the Star Child skull, you've been pounding this out for 12 years, pretty much on your own dime.
Right, pretty much, yeah.
And it must be difficult.
It's not. If it was easy, anybody could do it. It's a hard job. I've known, like I said, pretty much since 99 that we had the right thing, that it was going to pay off if I could just find a way to prove it. I mean, knowing it and being able to prove certain aspects of it, but not being able to prove it in an overwhelming way. You know the old scientific thing, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So they don't just take just any kind of evidence off of this. It's an extraordinary claim. We need extraordinary evidence, and we're going to get it with the DNA. So we're going to win. I mean, there's no question about it. We're going to win. As soon as we have the money to put it in the hands of the right people that we've lined up, it'll all fall into place, and we'll get it done.
Well, that's great, Lloyd. I for one, am glad you're doing it, and I look forward to every bite of pie just to see what you're doing and see how it's going. I'm riding the highs and the lows, and it's been a hell of a ride.
It's been a hell of a ride. You're right, exactly that. And more to come, but, you know, it's a good safe harbor at the end of it, and that's what counts. We're gonna do it.
Yeah. Okay, well, we gotta close up this week's program, and I very much appreciate Lloyd for joining us. I hope we can get back. I tell you what, when you do find out the DNA sequencing to, you know, to wherever you need it to be and make that discovery, I wanna hear from you. I wanna have you on the radio and talk about it.
I have to be honest with you, Scott. When we have that, we're going to be going on Larry King and Oprah and all those things with
yeah.
it. You know? Everybody's
yeah,
going to know about
more
it.
Power to you. More power to you. I think you should
right.
be. Everybody, you're going to
right.
your phone's going to be ringing off the hook. You'll be a very busy man, but just keep a slot open
so.
For me, will you?
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we'll see what we can do. But listen, it's great talking to you. It's been a good interview. I wish you very well with your show, and just, you know, keep knocking them out of the park, and I know that you'll rise in this field for sure.
I appreciate your time. And if you want to just give your websites again and your email
it's www.starchildproject.com, www.lloydpye.com, LLOYDPYE, P as in Paul, YE. And then the ebook is called The Star Child Skull Essentials. The video, Bites of Pie is the mailing list. Get on the mailing list, and you'll know when anything comes out that's worth seeing or getting or learning relative to the Star Child or the other things that I do.
And looking forward to your next book, Everything You Know Is Still Wrong.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Listen, thanks a lot, and we'll do it again sometime.
Okay. Next week, we're going to be having two shows on December 14th. We'll be doing our regular show and another show earlier in the day at 3:55 p.m. Pacific. It'll run to 5:55 p.m. Pacific, and it'll be with Bill Ryan, who'll be joining us for a live webinar with BBS Radio listeners and Project Avalon forum members. They will be able to ask Bill Ryan questions live on PA chat. You'll have to log in to do the text chat, but all the information for that is on the website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com. Bill will answer those questions live on the radio. This is a much anticipated event by Project Avalon members and should be very exciting. And then at our regular time, we'll be talking to Alan Seinfeld, who has a show on BBS previous to ours. And, just check out the website, www.spectrumradionetwork.com, and look under upcoming guests. That's it. We're out. Good night, Tom.
Good night, Scott.
We'll see you all next week.